This is a second session of an interview with Barbara Kidman for the University of Adelaide Oral History Project on the 14th of November 2005, interviewer Rob Lynn. Barbara, in the meantime, we've been talking about you doing honours. In the meantime, you've met Wren Potts. How did that come about?
Well, I think I met him through the SCM. In fact, I'm sure I met him through the SCM. I don't remember, actually, how I met him or the first time I met him or anything like that. He was doing maths at the university and later did honours maths.
So you'd become quite friendly, what, by third year, was it?
By third year we'd become quite friendly, I'd say.
And what was Wren's position at the time?
Well, let's see, he did... I did honours physics in 48. I did honours physics. And he did, by 1947, he was an honours maths. He was doing honours maths in 1947. So, he got a Rhodes Scholarship in 1948.
So when did he head off to the UK?
He headed off in 48.
And you had to finish your honours?
I was doing my honours.
Were you engaged by that time?
Yes, we were. We became engaged. I think it was probably that, in April that year, we became engaged. Because he wasn't allowed to get married under the Rhodes Scholarship. And Rhodes scholarships were very scarce then. There were almost none. So an opportunity to go overseas was very, very valuable.
So he headed to Queen's College to further his research.
And yes.
I suppose at that time it would have been very difficult to have done it anywhere else. The research side.
Well, possibly Cambridge would have been a better place, but the only way to go to Cambridge really was to finance yourself, so it was out of the question for him. He didn't have any money, so this was a great opportunity.
What was Wren's background, Barbara?
Well, he went to Prince Alfred College. His father was a master there.
Very famous master there,
yes,
it turns out.
Yes, yes. And he had to do engineering at the university. Because of the war, he was drafted into engineering at the university. He had a health problem with his... he had a problem with an infection in his arm, and I'm not sure whether he was fit, would have been fit to go straight. He tried to go into the services and instead was drafted into doing an engineering course at the university, which he started doing, and it wasn't really for him. He was not good at practical things, and sort of discovered that he loved maths, so decided to do honours maths. Or decided to study maths. Of course, he did physics and as well, but he got hooked on maths, and so he changed over to science. I'd have to look up. I can't remember. I don't know when it was that he actually left engineering and went into science, but he certainly was a science student when I knew him well.
Well, Barbara, how did it come about that you got to go to England in Wren's footsteps, if you like?
Well, he went over there in for the start of the academic year in about September 1948, and he went to quite a few... He wasn't really settled in what he was doing there, and he went to quite a few lectures, because although you have a tutor in your college in Oxford, you also go to university lectures. And he met a woman lecturer who I think was in mathematical physics, really, and she was at Somerville College, and he talked to her quite a lot. And she told, he told her that I would like to go to England, and she said, well, the that her the principal of Somerville College, who was a medical person, had a research group in Oxford who needed a physicist, and you could she couldn't find one. And so that began it. The negotiations were done mainly by post because telephoning was very difficult then. And it, she got references from the physics department about me. And the outcome of it was that I was offered a position as a research assistant on a 3-month trial. And so I left actually in December 1948, I left by ship to go to England.
And your father paid the fare?
My father paid the fare.
That would have been very helpful.
Yes, I was very lucky. My parents were always supportive like that. I mean, I didn't have the money to pay the fare.
Was it expensive in those days?
Well, comparatively it was expensive, but of course I travelled as cheaply as possible, but on a passenger ship, as Wren had done. And it took, I think it was 4.5 weeks or something it took to go there. I arrived at the end of January. So it was, I'm sure it was a big expense for him to pay for me to go, but he willingly did.
Were they still living at Port Lincoln, Bob?
Yes, yes.
So how did you find England?
Well, it was a wonderful experience going there. It was very, it was after the war, and so, I mean, there was still food rationing, and everything was very poor, the standard of food and the standard of clothes, I think. No, I think clothes had come off the ration, but people didn't have any money, and so the standard of living was not as high as I was used to in Australia. But it was terribly interesting. I mean, who wouldn't be interested in going to Oxford? And everyone had bicycles in Oxford, and we cycled for miles around Oxford on weekends and holidays, and we hitchhiked to places further afield, caught buses, and saw a tremendous lot.
How long were you there for?
I was there for 2.5 years. And the research team that I was with was working on the biological effects of radiation. Because remember, the atomic bomb had, of course, been used towards the end of the war, and not very much was known about the effects of radiation. And so in this group that I worked in, there were biologists and a chemist and a physicist. And Janet Vaughan had some space in the basement of the pharmacology building at the university, and so the group worked there. And that was a wonderful department. I mean, I wasn't a biologist, but they were a very, very active in research. The whole department was very research oriented, and so that was something, a new experience to me, with to be in a department where people were doing research. Of course, ours had nothing to do with pharmacology. It was just that they'd provided the space for Janet Vaughan's group. But we were given all the facilities of the department, and it was a great place to be.
Barbara, you marry Wren on the 1st of July 1950, and then Ren has to finish his DPhil, I think, doesn't he?
Yes, that's right.
Now, what brings you back to the University of Adelaide to rekindle that link?
Well, what happened was it was not good for me, for my career, because I had enrolled, had been able to enrol for a DPhil myself in Oxford, but I hadn't finished. But Ren had to get a job, and it was very, very hard to get a lectureship. He didn't want to go into school teaching. He wanted to get a lectureship, and his research had been in mathematical physics. He noticed that Professor Bert Green had been appointed as the inaugural professor of mathematical physics at the University of Adelaide, and they were advertising a lectureship. And he thought, well, we both thought, that if he'd had the opportunity to work with a person with his reputation in England, he would have jumped at it, so why not do it in Adelaide? So because he couldn't get a job in England, and because this opportunity seemed to be there, he applied for the position, but didn't get it because it was sewn up. One of Green's students had got the job. That had been prearranged. But when the people around the university heard about it, they desperately needed staff in the maths department, so they invited him to take a lectureship in applied maths. That seemed fine. The fields are related, and he imagined correctly that he'd be able to continue working with the mathematical physics group in Adelaide. So that's why he took the position. So we came back. It didn't enter either of our heads that it would have been better for me to have stayed on in Oxford and finished my DPhil.
How much more would you have had to go?
Probably a year.
Hmm.
Someone had already got a, or was in the process of getting a DPhil from the research that we were doing. It's sort of collaborative research, and really you had to wait your turn really to get it. So it would have been at least a year. What I should have done was, there is a degree at Oxford called a BSc, which is like an MSc, a research MSc in other universities, and I should have submitted a thesis for a BSc. But at the time I thought, I don't want that. It seemed to be a second-rate degree. I don't want it. But it was very silly. I should have done it, because a BSc from Oxford would have been good.
Now, when you come back to Adelaide, you begin a PhD here in Adelaide in 52?
Yes, beginning of 52.
And what was that based in, Barbara?
That was on what we called biophysics, which was the application of physics to biology, again, which is really what I've been doing in Oxford. But this was an entirely different field, because naturally I had to do what there was expertise at in Adelaide, and there was a fairly new lecturer in the physics department called Stan Tomlin, an Englishman, who had just got an electron microscope, and he was very anxious to have students working with the electron microscope. So I switched entirely and started again on an entirely different field, and worked under him on the uses of the electron microscope in biology. But we had to use physical techniques. So it was really physical techniques being applied to biological topics.
Now, Barbara, you told me that when you returned with Wren, that you really had no intention of staying for a long period, is that
we
right?
That's correct. Because we thought of it as just being a stepping stone. And, of course, we didn't stay for long, because Well, in 1955, we had a year, Wren had a year's study leave in America, and I wasn't able to work in that year. I went with him and didn't do any work. And then we came back for, I guess, 2 years, when I did take up a position, as I now had my PhD, and I took up a position still with Stan Tomlin's group as a... I got a research grant and I was a research assistant. So I started doing that, and then I stopped because of I was pregnant, and well, my husband wasn't very keen on me working, continuing to work, so I stopped. And then he got a job in Canada, which was a tenured position as an associate professor at Toronto, so we moved to Canada.
Now, just coming back to going to the US, did Wren get a Fulbright? Was that...
Yes, he did get a Fulbright.
Mm. So that enabled you to at least...
Well, that paid the fares, I think. I think he had a postdoctoral fellowship from the University of Maryland, and he had the Fulbright, which paid his fares and, I think, a few travelling expenses in the US. Mm.
So those wonderful endowed funds in America came to help.
They did, they did. I mean, it was would have been... We she was on study leave. He must have got his salary. I can't remember. It was very tight. We were very, very short of money in America. We had to be very careful. To manage on the money that we had.
So additional travel was probably very difficult.
It was difficult, because we went to a meeting of the American Physical Society. He was still doing mathematical physics. Wren was still doing mathematical physics, and we went to a meeting of the American, I think it's the American Physical Society, which was in Mexico City, and we travelled there and back by bus. It was 4 days of bus travel, 4 days and nights of bus travel, actually. But still, it was a very interesting experience.
A bit stretching?
Yeah, even then, when we were very young. It was very difficult. We didn't have any spare money, but we tried to make the most of what we did have.
Could we just talk for a moment about University of Adelaide in that interregnum between coming back from the US and going to Canada? What was there a social life also around the university in those years?
Yes, I think over the years the social life increased. I mean, as academics had very active social interactions, there were lots of dinner parties. I think later, more so, because we had lots of visitors. At that time, the university didn't have so many visitors. But still, there was a lot of social interaction and between academics. And it was good because this was a chance... to meet people from other countries, and I think that was the influx of overseas people that spurred this on, because everyone felt they had to be welcoming to overseas visitors, and so this set off, and of course they were utterly dependent on their social life at the university, whereas people who'd grown up in Adelaide had all their school friends and university friends. And so we moved out of that that sort of local social set, I would say, into the university-based social life, on the whole.
You said that progressive dinners were a great favourite.
Yes, yes. I remember those progressive dinner parties, which were... not good, I suspect, because there's a lot of alcohol was consumed, but there'd be a pre-dinner drinks at one house and soup at another house and main course at another house and pudding at another house. And so people had to drive between the houses. They weren't a success later, when we were more conscious of how much alcohol we'd had.
And Barbara, you still didn't own a house at that time?
No, we didn't own a house because we didn't want to settle in Adelaide. Ren really wanted to go to the US to work. And we'd been there in 1955 on sabbatical, and it opened up all sorts of opportunities to him. The person he worked with then became a close collaborator with Ren for many years, and we wanted to get back there, and that's why we went to Canada, because it seemed to be a foothold into getting into America.
Barbara, were there characters at Adelaide University in that mid-50s period?
Characters?
You mentioned one, Harry Messel.
Oh, yes. Well, Harry Messel, that's right, Harry Messel. He came out with Bert Green. He was a real character. Everyone always said that he bossed Bert Green around. I mean, Green was the professor and he was a lecturer, but he bossed him around. When I was working in the physics department, he happened to have a university house that was near where we lived in Walkerville, and he didn't have a car. He cadged lifts from people, and used to come home with us, and he was very... I mean, Ren came home when I wanted to, because I was working in the laboratory, and I used to have Harry pestering me from sort of about 4:30 onwards, trying to get me to go home. And he got very friendly with... this actually can't have been... because Roe was here. When did Roe come? Roe was the Vice Chancellor, and he was trying to persuade the university, Harry Messel was trying to persuade the university to set up a research institute in Adelaide. And there was a scene with him outside with Roe trying to persuade him to finance it. Outside, I remember seeing them talking outside the physics building. But then Harry, he worked very, very hard on it. I don't know, I think Bert was just in the background, Bert Green. And then Harry went to Sydney and met a physics professor from Sydney. And it ended up with, in a very short time, he was offered a job in Sydney. And so he left Adelaide. And, of course, he did start up this research institute in Sydney, which could have been done in Adelaide if the university had the initiative to finance it. They got private money for the Harry Messel's Fund thing in Sydney. So he was... I mean, I suppose Roe himself was a character, the Vice-Chancellor. I think it was not that period. I think it was probably... Oh, it must have been that period. During that period was the incident of the footprints, the university... This was a student prank. And one morning, it was late in the year, either November or December, when everyone arrived at the university, there were yellow painted footprints running from the Vice Chancellor's residence. He had a flat, or I think it was quite a large apartment, in the what had been the old anatomy building. It's now in the area where the Bar Smith Library is, on the upper level. And there were footprints running from his front door to Elder Hall, and then up the wall of Elder Hall, where a tailor's dummy was suspended from the turret of the little tower on top of Elder Hall, and the footprints on their way there diverted into the Prince of Wales building to go to the men's toilet, and then they went up there, and then I'm not sure. I think the footprints went to Bonython Hall, but anyway, the police, everyone in the university gathered around. I would say 9:30 in the morning. Everyone was looking at all of this, very amused about it. And while we were all looking at this, the caretaker was in a great flap, and the fire brigade was coming, and all this sort of thing. And in the middle of all of this, Skull and Crossbones flag burst out from the top of one of the Bonython Hall towers, and immediately the police and the security people surrounded Bonython Hall and got very excited about it, and they thought they'd caught them. Well, when they went up the towers, they discovered, of course, that this had opened. This flag had been launched by a mechanistic device, and there was no one there at all. So it was a huge joke. I don't think Mr. Rowe was amused about it. It amused everyone in the university. It was called the Abominable Rowman, and it must be the greatest student prank that ever happened at the university. And the who did it has never been announced. I do know one of the people. I would never divulge it. I didn't know at the time, but I learnt later who it was. And they were very, very clever people, I think. And it was an amazing... I mean, no one knows how they did it, really, because...
They're probably doyens of the community.
Yes, exactly. But... So, I mean, Mr. Rowe didn't get on with... I never had anything to do with him personally. I met his wife as a university academic. But he didn't get on with undergraduates. I always feel he's been misjudged by the university because, as a university guide... I had to explain to people why Mr. Rowe's portrait was put in the out of the way place when other vice chancellors had their portrait in a prominent position. I felt it's very wrong because he actually transformed the university from that lazy old teaching institution into a modern university. I think he introduced study leave. He thought that the academics were far too slow in their demands for support from government, and he transformed the university. So I think he deserves credit for that, really.
Well, I've never heard the other story before, Barbara. That's fantastic.
Which story was that?
The Abominable Rowman.
Oh, really?
No. Well, I knew about the footprints, but I'd never heard it in its entirety.
And I know it's pretty accurate because I've confirmed it. I haven't set the date. I'm going to try and determine the date. I think I can.
So, Barbara... sometime after this event with one child, you and Wren head off to the University of Toronto for a time that you personally don't enjoy all that much.
I didn't enjoy it. I think I was, because I'd been working most of my life and I wasn't working, and I felt very tired, and there weren't opportunities for me in Toronto to do anything, really. So I wasn't sorry when it proved to be rather short-lived.
Now, in the meantime, in the US, Wren had become involved in Detroit with operations research.
Yes, it actually transformed his life. I think he was technically head of applied maths in Toronto, and incidentally, after he left, a stream of Australians went to Toronto, so it sort of started something. But anyway, while he was there, he acted as a consultant for General Motors through a man whom he'd met while he was working in Maryland. And they were doing operations research at the General Motors Research Center. And so that sort of launched him on into that field, which is where he continued doing research for the rest of his life, really. That and mostly in that area.
So Barbara, he had an associate professorship in Toronto.
Yes.
And then the job in Adelaide, the professorship of mathematics is advertised?
The professorship of applied mathematics.
Mathematics.
There was one professor, and I think under Rowe, more funding came, and so they advertised for when Professor Sanders died, they advertised for two professors, pure and applied, and so Wren applied for the position and was appointed.
So after 2 years in Canada, you returned.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Were you anxious to come back to Adelaide itself, or would it have been any opportunity that had come up to you?
I think we'd like to have come back to Australia. I think we'd got a bit disillusioned with the United States as a place to live by then.
Why was that? Sorry to interrupt.
Well, it just all seemed busy. We hadn't been to California. You know, we felt differently about the United States after we'd been there, but our experiences there had been in Detroit and in Washington, and they were very busy places and not sort of academically inclined, really. So, I mean, we were a bit disillusioned about the way of life, I think, and the universities that we'd had contact with hadn't been particularly attractive.
Mm-hmm. So when did Wren take up the appointment of his professorship? Was that 58?
I think it was 59.
59.
The end of 59, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm. Were you still doing any work at university at that time?
When I came back here, I did some part-time teaching.
Mm. Was that in physics?
Yes. I don't think I did tutoring. I may have. I did earlier. I'd done tutoring in maths, part time, just casual, and I didn't immediately start doing that because we had some family problems. My mother was very ill, and a year or so later, I did some demonstrating in physics. Mm. I used to just go in for, I think, 6 hours a week or something like that. Taking Physics 1 classes of practical.
But you decided to let that go by?
I did, because I realised that I was very disillusioned with it, because when I'd been at Oxford, I'd been doing research, and when I came back as a doing a PhD in Adelaide, I'd been doing research, and then I went back into Physics 1 demonstrating, and I did literally demonstrate the same experiments that I myself had done as an undergraduate. And I thought, well, surely the world's changed since then. And I realised that experimental physics, if you're going to be successful at it, you have to spend long hours in the laboratory. You can't do it at home. Mm. So I thought I'd better do something I can do at home, do partly at home.
Mm.
So that's why I decided to take up something else. Mm.
So what did you take up?
Well, I had thought of doing statistics, because I'm not a brilliant mathematician, but I have mathematical ability. And I thought, well, statistics, there was a postgraduate diploma in statistics, and I thought if I did that, then I can probably do consulting in statistics. And And the, but Wren, he was the one that suggested that I do computing instead. There was also a postgraduate diploma in computing. So I went to see Professor Avanston, who'd just been appointed. This was, I'd say, the end of 1965. And he said, oh, no, you won't do that. I'll give you a job straight away. So he... I just had to do a little bit of training and I got a job as a programmer.
So you'd had your PhD by then?
Oh, yes.
Now, were you and Barbara Possingham the first two women?
Yes, we both were awarded our PhDs in 1956, and I think we were the first two women to get PhDs at Adelaide, the University of Adelaide.
So Barbara... with no previous background, almost, you begin computing, if you like.
That's right, yes. Well, no one had any previous background in computing because there weren't any courses. And so everyone had learnt on the job. And someone who'd done physics and maths had found learning to program fairly straightforward. So Avanston knew that very well. And so that's what happened to me.
Now, in the meantime, in 62, you and Wren had been back to America, to New York, for sabbatical.
In 62, yes. Yeah.
Then you returned again. And could you just describe how the computing course and what was going on there evolved over the 60s?
Well, it's a pity I didn't have the book. Wren and I wrote a history of computing at the university. And he was actually one of the prime movers in getting the university into computing. The university was, the administration at the university was thinking that they would have to use some sort of equipment to process enrolments at the university. And they were talking about getting some sort of punched card system. And Wren heard about this and thought it was very important that they use IBM equipment because of its compatibility around the world. And also he knew about the computing, so he persuaded the university to move in that direction. The Vice-Chancellor was then Henry Baston. He was extremely supportive when he knew what the situation was. Wren had gone to... when the first South Australian computer arrived, it was out at WRE, Weapons Research Establishment.
That's right, so it was.
And Wren had spent a summer there. I think it was before we went to Canada. He'd spent a summer working out there. He got a security clearance and went out there and learnt to program on the WRE computer and did a bit of work for them while he was out there. And then, of course, there was, in the 60s, after we were settled here, there was a computer being built in the engineering department, a computer called Cirrus. Building a computer was then a research project. And also there was a computer, a bigger, better computer, had arrived out at WRE. And so the university had to do something. Everyone wanted, there was a lot of pressure on it to buy a computer. And the engineering department wanted the university to fund this research project they had. There was a lot of controversy about it. But in the end, they bought a small IBM computer and set up a service out at the Weapons Research Establishment so they could use the two computers in conjunction. So he'd been very involved with that. And I arrived just at the... end of the little computer that the university had. Avanston was appointed and bought a very large modern computer, the largest in it, the most modern computer in Australia, most powerful computer in Australia. And he, the university had to borrow money to finance this. And he had to earn money by selling the services of the computing centre. And that's why you need a lot of programmers to program for all the people that wanted applications. So I was one of those application programmers. But in the meantime, he'd started courses. He started an honours course and he started this postgraduate diploma. The idea for the postgraduate diploma came from Cambridge. He'd been at Cambridge himself. He did his, I think he did a doctorate at Cambridge, Arvinston, and they started their computing courses with a postgraduate diploma. The idea was that it was a good way to get physicists and mathematicians and so on into computing. They were quite practical courses, but had theory in them. So it was a very good idea, really, and it's persisted, strangely enough, the postgraduate diplomas in computing. The way it started in Adelaide was they had a stream that was meant to be for commercial purposes and a stream that was more academic. When I arrived, the courses had just started. I think they'd been going for about a year when I came to the department.
So if one wanted to use the computer, would one make a booking or something for a time slot?
The small computer was run very informally. People operated it themselves. There was no operator. So I think you probably made a booking. When the big one came, it was a service. You didn't operate the computer yourself. There were operators, so it was a standard computer service. For people who were in the department, we used to, I think, originally put our own card decks into the computer, but that soon came to an end.
With the curriculum side of computing science, Barbara, how would people work it out with no textbooks and everything just beginning, and no settled curriculum? How did you?
Well, it was difficult. I was actually appointed to the, when I finally became a lecturer, which was 1970, towards the end of 70, I was appointed a lecturer. I was specifically appointed to launch a first year course, first year half subject. And really, it was very difficult to know what to put in the curriculum because it wasn't standard practice to have undergraduate first-year courses. There were a few textbooks about, but none seemed suitable. And we had only a half subject, so we couldn't do what you might like to put into a whole first-year course. But it wasn't meant to be just a programming course. I mean, you could do programming separately. It was meant to be an academic course. It was difficult. The procedure that was used was that I had to make a draft curriculum for the course and it was submitted to the departmental committee. And so we had their input into it too. So that's what was followed. It was far too ambitious, I think, the first course we had.
Now, did some of the ideas from that for that course come from your time in California in 1967?
Not really. When I was in Berkeley in 1967, again, Wren was on study leave and I wasn't allowed to get a job. I worked in the computing centre, really, and I just worked. I wasn't paid, I was just sort of an assistant, and I used their computer and did projects for them. But I wasn't involved with teaching, but it was good because it made me see how another university ran its computing centre, and I also mixed with people who were active in the field. So that was a very good experience for me.
Mm. Well, could you talk about how computing science evolves? I think you pick up a visitor readership in 78?
No.
Senior lectures.
Well, there's a lot of... The university was very reluctant to accept computing science as a discipline. I think that, by and large, in the Faculty of Science, physicists and chemists and biologists thought that computing science was programming. And it began in the maths department in Adelaide, the computing at Adelaide, because people were teaching numerical analysis and using the computer at Salisbury. But it was very, very difficult for Ovenston to get his courses into the curriculum. Now, the postgraduate diploma didn't present a problem to anyone. They were very happy with that course. And the third year course he got in because by then third year had been unitised. And so introducing third year units didn't interfere with students doing physics and chemistry and maths. But when it came to the lower undergraduate courses, the people were worried about losing students. They thought, now there aren't going to be so many chemistry students because they're going to be doing computer science. So there was bitter opposition to the introduction. He tried to get a first year subject and it wasn't. He couldn't get it through the faculty. And then statistics and computing came up with the idea of having two half subjects, and they were accepted. The half subjects were finally accepted after a long battle. And people, I think, they still were of the opinion that it wasn't an academic discipline because it was just programming. That was easy.
Mm.
But it was a continual battle to introduce computing components into the curriculum. It was repeated when it came to second year. I was very involved in the planning and introduction of our second year course, which was essential if we were going to have students doing modern honours physics. They had to have a proper undergraduate background in computer science, and it was very, very hard to get it introduced into the Faculty of Mathematical Sciences because, I think, essentially because everyone was afraid they'd lose undergraduates.
Oh.
You see, because there wasn't space in the... There wasn't a second year mathematical physics, so there was applied maths, pure maths and statistics. And everyone was afraid that students would go to computer science.
Did Wren have a continuing interest in it too?
He was always interested, and the applied maths department was always supportive because, I mean, they were realistic.
Mm.
And they weren't afraid of losing students. Mm. So when we introduced the second year course, it had to be unitised. There was a ridiculous system of mixed subjects was introduced. This was a compromise that we reluctantly agreed to because it was the only way we could get second year into the curriculum. And that was that you could do two-thirds computing and one-third statistics, two-thirds computing and one-third pure maths, that sort of arrangement. They had almost negligible enrolments in these mixed subjects. We had very large second-year classes in the faculty, and they were just a waste of time. They were a nightmare to fit into the curriculum, the timetable, all the bureaucracy associated with it was very difficult. And after a few years, they were removed because they weren't a success. I think they just had to learn to live with the fact that people do what they want. What happened, of course, later was that second-year subjects were unitised, and the problem disappears then.
Mm.
With unitisation of subjects,
mm.
which is probably should have been done earlier.
Did you find that time of your lectureship reasonably difficult at Adelaide on a personal level?
Yes, even later it was more difficult. I'd say in the middle years it was very hard work because we were introducing new courses. We had very large classes of students from all the way through. I mean, in third year at that time, you'd have seen about a dozen people doing third year physics, and we'd have well over 100.
Mm.
And we were always short-staffed because we weren't given enough staff. And even if you had a position, it was hard to find people to fill them. And the curriculum was changing all the time. The subject was advancing so rapidly, and I think that the unique situation of computer science is that you have to do practical programming, and it wasn't something that you did in a laboratory between 2 and 5. It was in those days we had to use the big computer with punched cards, and students had to spend a lot of time on their practical programming. It was very difficult for the students to get their cards punched. They used to mostly punch them themselves, and there was never enough equipment, and we weren't given enough tutors, that sort of staff, because I think the students needed a lot of help. And the university didn't recognise that. It was not being a laboratory subject. It was sort of caught between the two. It was a unique subject. So it was very difficult, and I worked very, very long hours.
Mm-hmm. But as a woman also, was there a difficulty there?
Well, there was later. I think the difficulties increased all the time I was in computing because there were very few women lecturers. I think the only other lecturer in the faculty, certainly in the Faculty of Mathematical Sciences, there was one pure maths lecturer who was a woman. There were none in physics and chemistry. There may have been one or two in the biological sciences and geology, but there was no network of women.
I'm just thinking Maud McBride would have been
botany. Yeah, but she wasn't a lecturer.
No, she wasn't, was she?
No, you see, no one... They were all...
That's right.
They were all demonstrators,
They got
junior positions, yes. There were very, very few lecturers, very few women lecturers.
Just thinking how capable she was.
Well, she was, and they were throughout the biological sciences and geology. There were very, very capable women, but always in untenured positions. And then they introduced a tenured position of senior tutor. But again, women tended to get delegated to that. That was a position that women got. Very, very few women became lecturers. So that was unusual, and there was no network of women. But some of the academic staff were very difficult, and I think went out of their way to be difficult to me because I was a woman. I think it was, I always call it the battle of the sexes. I mean, now there's an active feminist movement, and they were very anti that movement. And I was never an active feminist, feminist at heart, but I was never politically active in the movement. And I also found that undergraduates had problems in computing. Over the years, I had numbers of undergraduates who had difficulties because of with staff in the computing department in one way or another.
Oh, so this is young women.
Mm.
Mm.
Not so much. It's just they were offended by things that were done, particularly Asian students. Mm.
Was that a feature across the university in the era, or particularly in your department?
Well, I think the atmosphere about women was a feature across the university, but I'm not aware, of course, of what happened in other departments. I would have thought it was peculiar to computing, would be my instinct, but I may be wrong. Mm.
So, Barbara, you end up taking early retirement in 1987. Were there reasons behind that?
Yes. In the year or so before, things had changed in the department. We had a new professor, head of department, who was quite autocratic, and he wasn't a person that I got on well with, and I really thought I was unfairly treated. And Wren was going to retire in 1990, and I'd also had some health problems because I developed diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes, and I had been working two-thirds time as a result of that, and then I thought I did a normal week's work as working two-thirds time. And anyway, I decided that I'd get out of it. There was no need for me to work, and so after 20 years I retired.
You retired in one sense, Barbara, but not in another.
No, well, I did still have a research student, and I was an active member of the department while he was still working on his thesis. In the sense, I didn't go in there much, but I had a desk and a filing cabinet, and I used to go to seminars. And so I did, in that sense, stay active in the department. I was officially a visiting research fellow. And at that time, as a matter of fact, it was the library was very important to me, because I was using the Bar Smith a lot. And they didn't have the provision that came later, that retired academics got lifetime use of the Bar Smith Library. And so one reason why I liked being a visiting research fellow was that I could use the library.
Mm.
And then the other project that I was given, which I undertook to do and was very slow in finishing it, was to write this history of computing in the university. And so I was sort of delegated to do that unofficially, and didn't really do much about it for a number of years.
And then Wren came to help with that.
Yes, well, I was being very slow about it. The faculty started to get interested in it, and at first I was going to do it with Nick Capon, who was the former director of the Computing Centre, someone I knew very well. But he was like me, I think. He was a bit slow too in doing it. And in the end, he just really wasn't interested. And so finally Wren came into it, and together we did it, and it was very good us both doing it, because he knew a lot, and he worked at home, and I did the outside work. And I should say that people like Nick Cape on. Nick helped a lot with it.
Mm.
Lots of people helped us a lot.
And this came out as one of the 125th anniversary publications.
Yes, it was. It was just privately published. The university printed it, and we hadn't expected it to be a bestseller. In fact, we didn't sell it. We gave it away, and we've always been very glad we did it, because I think it's important to record things.
Mm-hmm.
Like this, it's things get forgotten, and we interviewed a lot of people. Everyone we could think of who'd had any connection with the early days of computing in the university, we interviewed. Mm-hmm.
And Barbara, from that time, you've developed, I suppose you'd call it, a passionate interest in the history of the university.
I have, because I think it was because I became a volunteer guide at the university, taking heritage tours. So I had to learn a bit about the history of the university. Wren had been very interested in the history of mathematics in the university at a time when no one else was. And he had himself written the history of the maths department, and he'd done private research on the first professor of mathematics, Horace Lamb, both here and in England, and had written that up. And so he was interested, so that sort of spurred me on too. And I became very interested in it and did a terrific lot of reading and sort of research in quotes, looking things up. And then, of course, I later became, when the archives volunteer group started, I went, joined that, and that has been a great experience. I've become very interested. And I've also come to realise that I do have an exceptional knowledge of lots of things about the university, which has just happened because I've been interested.
Mm.
We could,
yeah. Barbara, one other facet of university life with which you're involved were the equal opportunity at the university.
Yes, well, it became trendy, I suppose, to have equal opportunity officers in various institutions, and the university appointed an equal opportunity officer who I thought was very, very good and very nice. I've forgotten her name. And a committee was formed in this regard, and we, I think, had to deal with any complaints and also to look at things that the university should be doing. But in the same area, there was a lot of concern at the university because of the inequality of the numbers of tenured staff as vis-a-vis the genders. There were very few women who had tenured positions, and there were very few women in science and maths, period. And I think the same in the arts, considering the number of students. And the women who were on the staff tended to be tutors or demonstrators. And so there was concern that this was because the selection committees weren't being fair. Well, of course, that really wasn't the case. I mean, the reason was that women weren't applying for the positions.
Hmm.
And that was probably because there weren't many suitably qualified women, I imagine. I mean, my case, I just out of the blue applied for a lectureship and I was appointed. I have no doubt that I was the best applicant because I wouldn't have been appointed otherwise. I think women all have that experience that you have to be the best to be appointed.
Hmm.
Well, certainly early on. But so there was a lot of concern about this. So they brought in all sorts of rules, like you had to ask women to apply when a position was advertised. Women had to be invited to apply. So it was all the selection committees had a difficult job trying to... The departments had to try to find, suggest names of women who had to apply for positions. So that was... It was a lot of work. I don't know whether that was successful or not, whether that led to people being appointed who wouldn't have been otherwise. I can't answer that. All I know is that I got on committees because of it. And that was a bit of a nuisance, really, because it was time-consuming.
Mm.
So I think all women academics got onto committees because of that. I always feel these things are overdone. I thought that the equal opportunity requirements were greatly overdone. I mean, you must give people equal opportunity, but I'm not sure that there needs to be so much fuss about it. I suppose if you work with people of goodwill, it wouldn't be necessary. And I mean, I know that my husband wouldn't have been... He would have given everyone equal opportunity, I mean, all of his life, even though he grew up in a different time. He acknowledged that I gave up my career for him. And, I mean, neither of us thought anything of it at the time.
Mm.
But it was just what we did. But in retrospect, we realised that had happened. But he was always very fair, and he would have been very fair in dealing with any staff that he had. And I just sort of assumed that most academics were like that. I may be wrong, till I went into computing, and then I discovered they weren't. So I suppose it's necessary to have these sort of bureaucratic approaches to things, but it did take up a lot of time.
Mm. Well, Barbara, we have an overview today, and you've talked about your whole life really as part or parcel off and on of the University of Adelaide. Thank you very, very much for being willing to provide all that thoughtfulness and experience that you have yourself.
Well, I hope it's helpful to someone.
Thank you.